Let the drums roll out. Let the trumpet call. While the people shout, strike up the band. Hear the cymbals ring, calling one and all. Now's the time to swing, strike up the band. There is work to be done, to be done. There is more to be won, to be won. Come, you son of a gun, take your stand. Fall in line, yeah, Bo. Come along, let's go. Hey, leader, strike up the band.
Michael Feinstein's career as a musician and revivalist interpreter of the Great American Songbook has earned him 5 Grammy nominations, but before his music career took off, he received a chance to work for his idol, Ira Gershwin. In his new book, The Gershwins and Me, A Personal History in 12 Songs, Mr. Feinstein combines part history of the Gershwin brothers and their music and part memoir. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased that it's brought Michael Feinstein back to our show. Hello.
Oh, hello, Leonard. Thank you.
I forgot to mention there's also a nightclub named after you.
Yes, yes. 14 years, is it?
And it's a place where the Great American Songbook is kept alive.
Indeed. That's our stock in trade, as they say.
Well, how did you become a cataloger for Ira Gershwin? You don't just knock on the door and say, I'm your biggest fan, and get hired.
It's true. It was a circuitous number of events, circuitous circumstances that led me there. I had moved to Los Angeles from my hometown of Columbus, Ohio. I was collecting records, and I went into a record store where this guy had these private recordings of Oscar Levance that I couldn't believe. Things dating back to 1934 that were recordings of his own music, his piano concerto and his sinfonietta and radio appearances. And it was amazing.
One of the wittiest men that ever lived.
Oh, he was incredible. He was incredible. He was so witty that Groucho Marx refused to go on his television show for fear of being bested. I mean, that's saying something. And he said famous things about George Gershwin. He said, tell me, George, if you had your life to live all over again, would you fall in love with yourself again?
Ooh. Was George Gershwin that much of an egomaniac?
He had a very healthy ego, but everybody I spoke to who knew him said that he had a great perspective about himself, and it was not unpleasant, the fact that he had ego, because he knew that he was good and there was no false modesty. And he was very kind about other people, so it wasn't all-consuming. It was just practical and honest.
Well, when you've written some of the greatest songs of all time, whether you're George Gershwin or Irving Berlin or Cole Porter, I would think you would have a healthy ego.
Yeah, if somebody said, George, I think Porgy and Bess is wonderful, he would say, thank you, I do too.
So what was Ira like at the time that you met him? Well,
I met June Levant through finding these records. Somebody I knew her, gave me her phone number. I called her up. I became friends with Mrs. Levant. She discovered there was this 20-year-old kid who knew about Oscar Levant and the Gershwin family. She had lunch with Ira Gershwin's wife, who asked to meet me. And a few weeks later, I was sitting in their living room talking to Ira and hired to catalog his collection of phonograph records. And it ended up being an entree to the house that lasted for 6 years and 1 month until his death in August of 1983.
And did it give you an insight into the things that you would need for your future career? Or was it just a cataloging job, is like being a file clerk before you go out and get your first job on the Broadway stage?
For me, everything was an education, because cataloging those records, I would have to play and listen to these records, and they dated back to 1917, and they were radio broadcasts that were interviews and obscure things I couldn't have heard anywhere else, and I listened to them with Ira. So he would tell stories, or his memory would be jogged about something, or he would say, oh, I like the way she sang that. Oh, no, that didn't happen. So it was my college education, and then I played the piano. And he started teaching me about interpreting the songs, about phrasing, about lyrics, things that I couldn't have learned anywhere else.
Were they okay with people playing with their songs? Some of the great writers of the Great American Songbook wanted the songs to be sung exactly as written. Others were very happy when someone like Billie Holiday or Dinah Washington or Sarah Vaughan took certain liberties.
Ira didn't like it when people took lyrical liberties because he worked so hard on those lyrics. And it makes sense to me. It's like changing Shakespeare. I mean, Ira said he didn't mind if somebody changed a lyric if it made it better. And he really didn't. It's just that when Frank Sinatra sang, "I view the morning with much alarm," that changed the meaning of the phrase because it's "I view the morning with alarm." It wasn't "with much alarm." Those sorts of things bothered him. Interpretively, he didn't like jazz a lot. He loved Ella Fitzgerald. He didn't like the way Sarah Vaughan sang Gershwin because vocally he didn't like the vocal pyrotechnics, but I liked it. He didn't like Art Tatum because he thought Art Tatum was too he said he should be given a ticket for speeding. He gave me all of his Art Tatum records, which I still treasure. So it was odd. He was more traditional. Now, George loved jazz. He loved Art Tatum. He used to go to downtown clubs and listen to Tatum all the time.
Well, George's role in jazz history is really very, very big. He wrote "I Got Rhythm."
Yes.
And "I Got Rhythm" was then adapted by pretty much every jazz composer for years, Duke Ellington, Charlie Parker, whoever, the basic chord changes of that, to write all sorts of jazz standards.
It's amazing, and I don't think that George expected that to happen. It was something that evolved, and it delighted him. Because he wasn't a jazz musician, and he loved jazz. Late in his life, he met George Bassman, who was hired to orchestrate for the Astaire film A Damsel in Distress. And George Bassman was brought on to the picture to orchestrate Astaire's drum dance because they wanted someone who could do swing arrangements because swing was just coming in 36 and 37. And George Bassman said, "Oh," Gershwin said to me, "Oh, I wish I could orchestrate like that. I wish I knew how to do that." So he had an appreciation.
But Benny Goodman, wasn't he the first person to play Rhapsody in Blue? Or one of
no, Paul Whiteman. Paul Whiteman, February 12, 1924.
The man they called the king of jazz, although.
Right, he was not. But Goodman played Rhapsody in Blue with Toscanini and was so nervous that he hit a clam on the clarinet, which did not please the maestro. That was 45, I think.
So there was always this interaction. And there were all these stories about Gershwin going up to Harlem with people like Kitty Carlisle because he appreciated the music so much.
Oh, yes. I asked Kitty what it was like to go to Harlem with George Gershwin. She said, "We were persona grata." She said that everybody was thrilled to see George Gershwin. She said it was an incredible experience.
On the other hand, Porgy and Bess wasn't greeted with great warmth by everybody in the African-American community.
Not only the African-American community, but the Tin Pan Alley community, the Broadway community, the opera community, the Jewish community. I mean, everybody was after him for that. And yet he resolutely maintained that it was his greatest work and it would be something for which he would be most remembered. And, of course, he was right.
I don't know if it's his greatest work, but it's a very great work. He wrote so many great songs, it's really hard to say what's the greatest. It's interesting you have a new CD and you do not sing Summertime, the most famous song from it.
Well, the CD only is with the book. It's not independent. And so each chapter in the book is titled after a song, a Gershwin song. So the CD is the 12 songs after which the chapters are titled. And Ira didn't write the lyrics to Summertime. So that's one of the reasons I didn't include it. And also it's been recorded so many gazillion times. And I like it best in the way it's set in the opera because the orchestration and the ostinato and the harmonies are such that for me it doesn't get better than that, even though I like the way Janis Joplin did it.
Well, what about Miles Davis?
Yeah, I like that. I like it a lot. But still, the original setting is what most moves me.
So what did you choose from Porgy and Bess?
I did "I Got Plenty of Nothing," which I suppose is an odd choice.
But Ira wrote the lyrics to that?
Ira co-wrote the lyrics with DuBose Hayward, so... I wanted to include that because it was a song that Ira and George were very proud of. I remember Ira telling me that when George first played it for Todd Duncan, the original Porgy, he said, "This is going to be one of your great anthems." And it has only been given pop recordings a few times, most notably, I think, Frank Sinatra with a great Nelson Riddle arrangement. So I wanted to take a crack at it.
My guest is Michael Feinstein, who... has written a book called The Gershwins and Me, A Personal History in 12 Songs. It includes a CD with 12 songs, and it is published by Simon & Schuster. Now, they grew up together. Did they start composing songs together from the start?
Well, George started writing songs quite early, and Ira was writing verse. And Ira started writing songs with other people, even though he did write a little bit with George. But after George had a hit with Swanee in 1919, Ira didn't want to trade on George's success because all of a sudden George was in demand and Ira wasn't. But throughout the early part of the 20s, they did collaborate, but Ira used a pseudonym of Arthur Francis, the name of their other brother and sister. So he wouldn't be perceived as taking advantage of George's success. And then by 1924, he used his own name with Lady Be Good, and the rest is literally history.
So 1924, that's still fairly early. What had George written of any importance before that?
Swanee, and then he wrote Stairway to Paradise. He wrote Do It Again. He wrote, of course, in 1924, he wrote Rhapsody in Blue. 1924 was a watershed year for George because he wrote Rhapsody in Blue. He wrote Lady Be Good. He wrote a show in England called Primrose. I mean, that was the beginning of his high-speed creativity.
And they wrote a bunch of shows which had many hits, but the shows didn't necessarily make it. What were scripts by George Kaufman not good enough?
Well, Kaufman
Murray
came.
Riskin?
Those came later. The Gershwin shows, musical shows, were no different from any of the others. I mean, the Rodgers and Hart shows, the Vincent Humans shows, they all had books that were forgettable, and the shows did run. The shows were successful, but they weren't revivable because in 20 years, nobody cared about these stories.
And that's been a problem in reviving some of these shows. They really don't age well.
They don't age well. But look at the plot of Nice Work If You Can Get It. I mean, that's no plot at all. And, you know, but it's the songs and the performances that sustain it.
So let's talk about the Great American Songbook. What qualifies a song for the Great American Songbook? Most of these came out of Broadway musicals or movies, but not all of them.
True. For me, the thing that the definition for me of a great American songbook song is something that lasts, because these are songs that have transcended the time in which they are written. Because people say, what are the years? What is the period? And I say that it is ever evolving, because I believe that Billy Joel, New York State of Mind, is a great American songbook song. I mean, I think that there are things...
Songs by the Beatles?
Yes, even though they're not American, but they're part of the American culture. I think Yesterday is part of the Great American Songbook, even though it's a bad lyric. I mean, it's a modern lyric, but it doesn't matter because it is part of the fabric and the culture. So there are things being created today that I think are part of the Great American Songbook, and people say, what? I say, ask me in 20 years, because in 20 years, what lasts? You look at all the songs that were written in the 20s and 30s, and there's a lot of music that was flash in the pan, big hits that haven't sustained. And so those are not classics. They're not ones that people still want to hear.
So this is just about many different people wanting to perform a song over the years.
That's a good point. In the 20s and 30s, songs were not connected with a specific person. It was not a singer-songwriter. And of course, it's harder for a song to step out and become a songbook standard, because most people equate a particular performance with a song and with a record and with a specific sound. And so can that song be divorced from that particular record and interpreted and recorded by a lot of people and therefore sustained?
Now, after George died, Ira worked with a lot of other really good composers.
Indeed, yes.
But he also felt it was his responsibility to protect his brother's legacy.
Oh, very much so. Ira always said that George was his favorite collaborator, and he had these hundreds of unpublished melodies that he was always trying to find a place for. And he had Kay Swift, who was George Gershwin's lover and an amazing woman. She actually came in from memory, wrote down a bunch of tunes that would otherwise have been lost. And Ira fashioned a posthumous score in 1946, the shocking Miss Pilgrim with Betty Grable. And his last professional work, Kiss Me Stupid, a Billy Wilder film, also consisted of three songs with George's posthumous music.
But he didn't allow other people to write lyrics for any of them. So I'm assuming there's a huge treasure trove of songs that George wrote that we'll never hear.
That's true. Yip Harburg wanted very much to write lyrics to some of those tunes, and Ira was basically saying, not while I'm alive. The Bergmans recently were approached about writing some lyrics for some Gershwin melodies, so we may still see some new Gershwin songs.
A few weeks ago, there was a production called Mr. Gershwin Goes to Washington with lyrics by Ira, music by George Gershwin and Burton Lane, and it featured political songs. I don't normally think of Gershwin in terms of political songs, and the reason they did it was obviously the election coming up, but so many great songs grew out of shows that they did that had political themes. So we're talking about Of Thee I Sing, Love is Sweeping the Country, Union Square, Strike Up the Band, Winter Green for President. Amazing.
Yes. Well, Strike Up the Band was the first what they call political musical. They wrote three of them, Strike Up the Band, then Of Thee I Sing, which won a Pulitzer Prize, the first musical to win a Pulitzer Prize, which the authors got, Ira, Riskin, and Kaufman, and George did not because they didn't give a Pulitzer for music. And Ira was so embarrassed by that that he kept the Pulitzer Prize in his bathroom. And then later, Ira wrote a song with Burton Lane called In Our United State, which must be the which has political allusions, which must be the other song there.
Were they very political?
Ira was not. George was not either. Neither of them were political, even though Ira was strong-armed into writing a parody for Adlai Stevenson to Love is Sweeping the Country in the 50s. Adlai sweeping the country, he will be the next press. No, because that's what everybody says. So much for that. And the other one he wrote was, it ain't necessarily so. They say Ike's arranging for things to be changing, but it ain't necessarily so.
He loved inner rhymes.
He did, yes.
We don't hear many of them. Even in the most clever rap lyrics, you don't hear too many rhymes that are in the middle of a line.
Yeah, it was the subtlety and the sounds of the words that were important to Ira. Like Yip Harburg, you know, with Happiness is a Thing Called Joe, there's a rhyme, an inner little rhyme that people always miss. It seems like happiness is just a thing called Joe. No one ever gets that right.
Now, Gershwin was self-taught on the piano. Do you see that? And so was Irving Berlin, which yeah. is interesting. Do you see that reflected in the music?
Well, there's a big difference between Gershwin and Irving Berlin, that Irving Berlin could only play in the key of F sharp and was not a good pianist. Gershwin was an extraordinary pianist, and he did have instruction later, but it still was largely instinctive. He couldn't play other people's music well, but the music came out of his ability to play the piano in a way that was unique to him.
In your next appearance at your club, are you doing an all Gershwin?
In December, yes. I'm going to do a Gershwin tribute, a Gershwin holiday, and it's going to be with the great Alan Broadbent as my musical director, a great jazz pianist. So looking forward to that.
Well, you also play piano.
I do. I'll be playing as well. But one way to find a different take on a Gershwin song is to work with a great jazz musician.
Michael Feinstein, his book, The Gershwins and Me, with a bonus CD featuring 12 songs. A Personal History in 12 Songs is the subtitle. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Oh, thank you. It was a great pleasure.
It's wonderful. It's marvelous. You should care for me. It's awful nice. It's paradise. What I love to see, you've made it.